Dr. Chang would keep the tests off Yale's record. As far as he was concerned, Yale had only come to see him for a sore throat. When he applied for new insurance, Yale would just be asked about a history of AIDS, not about the virus. "You will not be lying when you say no," Dr. Chang said. "And then a month after you're approved, you come in for the test again. Officially." But it was risky. And if it was ever discovered, if the government seized test results, anonymous as Dr. Chang claimed he'd kept them, or if Yale was in an accident, had blood drawn at the hospital, etc., he could be denied coverage forever. He'd wind up like Katsu, praying one of the beds at County would be open when he needed it. Yale called Asher, hoping he'd say something reassuring, but what Asher said was, "Get a job fast." Complicating matters was the fact that he could no longer get a letter of recommendation from Bill Lindsay. And it didn't look great that Yale had worked at Northwestern less than a year. Right after his own positive test, Yale had sent a note to Roman through campus mail, and then he'd addressed a letter to Bill at the office. "I have specific reason to believe that if you haven't done so already, you might consider getting tested for HTLV-3, the virus known to cause AIDS. I hope you'll advise your wife to take this test as well. Please be assured that I have not contacted her and will not do so." He'd thought for days about Dolly Lindsay, ways to reach out to her. He'd debated it with Asher, with Teddy, with Fiona. They all surprised him by shaking their heads in the same skeptical way, saying, "I don't think you really can." Teddy had thrown some cant at him, made a particularly compelling argument. In August, he heard from Cecily that Dolly had left Bill. "I've seen her around town," Cecily said, "shopping and stuff. Really, Yale, I don't think they were even sleeping together. Do you?" But he'd never heard back from Bill, with the exception of a note written in Bill's spidery script, attached to a stack of semi-personal mail the gallery had forwarded him. "It's grand to hear you've landed on your feet." Yale had indicated no such thing. He heard from Donna, the docent, that Bill was no longer talking about retirement. His visit to County would be short. Katsu was doped up, and Yale wanted to get the hell out of there. The beds were all in one huge room, separated only by hanging sheets, so that the sounds and smells of 30 different stages of death surrounded you. How anyone could sleep in that place, how anyone could harbor a single hope, Yale couldn't fathom. Katsu said to him, slurred really, "My armpits hurt. Why do my armpits hurt so bad?" Yale had brought him a milkshake, and he left it on his tray for when he felt up to it. He knew from Teddy that Katsu kept his Walkman under his pillow so it wouldn't get stolen, but no one would steal a milkshake, would they? Certainly not the nurse who'd avoided even looking at Katsu when she changed his IV bag. Yale wanted to get Asher in there to raise hell, but what could he possibly accomplish? Yale had signed his own power of attorney over to Asher last month, confident that Asher would at least know how to yell at the right people. Katsu said, "Can you make them turn the lights off?" But the lights were huge and fluorescent and covered the whole area, and Yale already knew they never turned them off, even at night. He folded two Kleenexes together and put them over Katsu's eyes. A makeshift sleeping mask. When he got home, the strangest thing, a letter addressed to him in Charlie's print. Charlie's odd way of making ease, three floating rungs with no vertical support. Light blue paper, dark blue pen. "He'd heard," it said. It said that Teddy and Asher and Fiona, all three, had assured him he wasn't directly responsible, but that he wanted to hear it from Yale. It was terrible, Charlie wrote, to assign blame to people rather than to the virus itself, or to the power structures that let it thrive. But he couldn't help it, and he wanted to know, even though he was, at the very least, indirectly responsible. He wanted absolution, Yale gathered. It wasn't something Yale was ready to grant. Yale didn't write back, but he didn't throw the letter away either. 6 months ago, he might have burned it. Now he smoothed it flat and put it under the pewter bowl on the dresser, the one he kept his change in. He picked up Roscoe and carried him to the window and stood looking down at the river, at the tour boat gliding by, impossibly slow. Soon enough, it had passed. 2015. Richard said, "The best one for dancing was Paradise. I'm sure that's long gone as well." Fiona said, "Brace yourself. It's a Walmart now." "No." He turned from his studio sink, hands dripping. Serge, from the reclining chair in the corner, listened with amusement. Cecily sat with Fiona at the big wooden table. She wore a beige turtleneck sweater today, one that in its solid plainness made her look protected from the chaos of the city, the poison darts of family. "It's like they were trying to be symbolic," Fiona said. "At least it's not a GOP headquarters or something. Richard, listen. There's a Starbucks at Belmont and Clark. It's not as sterile as I'm making it sound, but it's not the same. Every winter they have this soup walk. You go from restaurant to restaurant and you get soup. Everyone's out there. Gay guys, straight couples, babies in strollers, and soup. It's beautiful. You wouldn't want it to be the same. Because the vibe before, it came from an outsider place. And there was, you know, there was desperation all around. Even before AIDS." "So it's grown up," Richard said. "No more Boys Town," Serge laughed. "Man's Town." No one else appreciated it. Richard said, "Do you ever think it's just a fleeting moment?" No, she didn't. Not really. It was hard to imagine going back, losing ground. He said, "Because I do. I'm sure I'd roll my eyes at the gentrification. But listen, honey, I'm old and I've seen a lot of shit. And I'm telling you, let's enjoy it while it lasts. Because this isn't Mother May I. You're not always advancing. I know it feels that way right now, but it's fragile. You might look back in 50 years and say, that was the last good time." Fiona pulled her sleeves over her hands. It was so tempting to think of all the fires of her 20s as being the great historical struggle of her life. All past tense. Even her work at the store, her lobbying and fundraising, always felt like aftermath. People were still dying, just more slowly, with a bit more dignity. Well, in Chicago, at least. She considered it one of her great moral failings that, deep down, she didn't care on quite the same visceral level about the ongoing AIDS crisis in Africa. It didn't stop her from donating money to those charities, but it bothered her that she didn't feel it in her core, didn't cry herself to sleep over it. 1 million people in the world had died of AIDS in the past year, and she hadn't cried about it once. 1 million people. She spent a long time asking herself if she was racist, or if it was about the width of the Atlantic Ocean. Or maybe it was because it wasn't happening primarily to the gay community there, wasn't only killing beautiful young men who reminded her of Nico and his friends. Of course, all altruism was in some way selfish. And maybe, too, she only had room in her heart, in this lifetime, for one big cause. The arc of one disaster. Claire, it seemed, had certainly grown up feeling it, that her mother's greatest love was always focused on something just over the horizon of the past. Cecily said, That's the difference between optimism and naivety. No one in this room is naive. Naive people haven't been through real trials yet, so they think it could never happen to them. Optimists have been through it already, and we keep getting up each day because we believe we can keep it from happening again. Or we trick ourselves into thinking it. Richard said, "All belief is a trick." Serge said, "No one in France is an optimist." Richard's studio was L-shaped, with screens and cameras and lights at one end, desks and computers and mess at the other, and in the middle, where they all were now, a seating area, a kitchenette. The place had been decimated by the move to the museum, and loose power cords and packing peanuts littered the floor. Fiona had not come here to see the videos. She made it clear this wasn't the right time. It was 2 o'clock on Sunday. Tomorrow was supposed to be Richard's vernissage, but everything was still up in the air. There was a manhunt for one of the terror suspects underway near the Belgian border. As soon as they'd gotten to the studio, they'd locked the door behind them. The radio on the counter played the BBC News too softly to hear, and Serge kept updating them from his Twitter feed, but there wasn't much to report. Richard was waiting on the call from the Pompidou, the decision on whether it would open at all tomorrow, let alone proceed with the festivities. Even if things were a go, the party would be sparsely attended. The Pompidou wasn't far from the Bataclan Music Hall, which was still a scene of carnage, according to the news, although the only photos Fiona could bear to look at were of flower heaps, teddy bears. Some of the most important guests would have been coming from out of town, and Lord knew what would happen to their flights, their trains. Late last night, Damien had called to say that Claire had emailed him at his university address. Just 5 sentences to say she was fine and he shouldn't worry. He spelled Claire's email address for her, an address she wasn't supposed to use, of course, and he read her the email twice through. No apology, but no anger, no stiffness either. How different from the 2 tense conversations she'd had with Fiona. Well, Claire's issues were largely with her, not with Damien. The child psychologist had explained it years ago. They lash out at the parent they live with, the safe one. And it came out during therapy that Claire understood far more than they'd hoped about Fiona's affair. She believes, the psychologist had said, that you were looking for another family, a better family. Fiona stuck the piece of paper with Claire's email address into her bedside drawer. She had already memorized it. Richard's phone finally rang, and he retreated down to his desk to pace and talk. When he returned, he shook his head. "Not the Pompidou," he said. "At this point, if they call, I'm going to say no. I want to wait a week. Next Monday, don't you think? They can let the public in whenever the hell they want, but if we're doing the vernissage at all, we're doing it right. But listen, good news. Fiona, I told you there was a surprise for you. It was going to happen tomorrow night, but, you know." Fiona braced herself. Richard sometimes had strange ideas of what other people would enjoy, and if he was about to present her with a video of Nico, she wouldn't be able to handle it. "That was the call," he said. "Go wait by the door, okay? 2 minutes. You'll see." "Just me?" "Just you." She gave him a skeptical look, but walked out into the hall and then into the little entryway, where she could see through the glass door and onto the street. Her stomach didn't feel good. Her head didn't feel good. A dark-haired man in a blue coat passed, looking at his phone, and then backed up and faced the door fully. He grinned at her. He was around her age, with strange cheekbones, a face that was somehow wrong, skewed, scrambled. Then the features rearranged themselves, and rearrange themselves again. And instead of unlatching the door, letting him in, Fiona took a step backward, because she was looking at a ghost. This man could not be, but was, Julian Ames. And because he was still grinning at her, because what else was she supposed to do? She finally stumbled forward and figured out the lock and tried to push the door before realizing she needed to pull, needed to flatten her body against the wall to make room. He clasped her arms, brought his face close to hers. He said, "Well, look at you." 1988-1989. Charlie had an infected eyelid. This was what Asher told him, and then he said, "I'm not going to update you on every little thing, but I thought I'd tell you, and then I thought I'd ask how often you want to report. Basically, the doctors are saying this definitely counts now as rapid progression." Asher's Chevette was heading down Lakeshore Drive, and they both had to shout over the engine roar. Yale had grown skittish about public transportation, about the germs on the handrails, the spittle in people's coughs. He'd do it occasionally, but he was tired today, and the AZT made his legs weak, and so he didn't feel bad taking Asher up on the ride home from support group. Besides which, it was the first spring day when you could drive with the window down, and the lake looked like a glassy cliff. Like if you walked to the horizon, you could jump off the edge of the world. Yale said, "Mostly people have been filling me in on the drugs. Like I'm supposed to take some perverse pleasure in this." Asher turned on the radio, but it was just ads. He said, "I want to throttle him. He could be doing so much good with that money." About a year ago, thanks to the sudden proliferation of 1-900 numbers and the companies willing to spend a lot of money advertising them, Charlie's paper had become, for the first time, quite lucrative. More lucrative than Yale had ever imagined a gay newspaper could be. On top of this, he'd sold off the travel agency, just cashed out, intending to spend his remaining time in luxury, if not in comfort. And then he had apparently spent all the money on coke. It surprised Yale, at least in the sense that Charlie had been, in the past, a highly selective drug user. And it also didn't surprise him at all. But meanwhile, the paper was falling apart, or at least the staff was. Raphael had defected to Out and Out. Dwight was dead, and Gloria was still there but wasn't speaking to Charlie. There were new people, but from what Yale had heard, they hated Charlie. And Charlie hated them, and it was in general a horror show. One of the stranger results of Charlie's coke habit was that, following a long pause after that first letter, he'd taken to writing Yale manic 8-page missives about once a month. Yale suspected he wasn't the only one receiving these letters. But he was presumably the only one for whom Charlie made obsessive lists with titles like "Dreams I've Had About You" and "Here Are All the Books You Left." Some of them were darkly funny. "Ways I'll Kill Myself If the Republicans Win This Fall" included an entry on letting leeches suck all his blood, and then having someone serve those leeches at the inaugural ball. Charlie never proposed meeting. After that first needy letter, he never asked for anything at all. Yale had become a figure in a writing exercise, a static memory for Charlie to bounce feelings off of. He never apologized either, not in so many words. There were just the lists. And then, in jagged print that carved at the page, meticulous accounts of his days. What he ate, his weight, his digestive issues, the plots of movies he'd seen. He was keeping strictly vegetarian, and Dr. Vincent implored him to eat more protein. Teresa had gotten herself an apartment not far from Charlie's, and Martin seemed a permanent appendage, although Charlie spared Yale any details about their sex life, including whether they even had one. Sometimes the letters weren't about Charlie at all. Once, for no discernible reason, there were 5 pages about wanderlust, a drag queen who'd died before Yell even moved to the city. Yell tended to wait a few days before opening a letter. He'd sit, finally, on Saturday morning with coffee, consider the thickness of the envelope, and finally slide a finger under the flap. He'd never written back. Not out of spite or stubbornness so much as the fact that he couldn't imagine where to begin. The letters had softened him on Charlie, at least a bit. Had made him seem less the villain and more the pathetic sap Yale had always known he really was. Over the past 2 years, he'd seen Charlie from a distance a number of times. He imagined Charlie had seen him from a distance, too, on days when Yale was too distracted to notice. He imagined that Charlie caught his breath, turned, made some excuse to leave the party, the bar, the meeting, the same way Yale always did. Yale tried to picture an infected eyelid. Puffy, he assumed. Red. It made his own eyes water. They turned off the drive, and at least the engine was quieter now. Asher said, "I think he's scared. Okay, I'm just going to say this. He wants to see you." I doubted. "No, he told me. Several times. I'm supposed to tell you that he wants to see you." Yale had meant to knock the side of his head into the window, but since the window was down, his head flopped out into the rushing air. "Think about it. I'm just planting a seed. If he wants to apologize, that's one thing. I consider giving him some closure. But I'm not swooping in to hold his hand." "I know." Asher had one of those gay dollar stamps and a pad of red ink in his center ashtray, and Yale wondered if he was still stamping all his money. He picked up the stamp, ran his thumb along the letters. Leave it to Asher to keep this stuff in the car, so he could engage in civil protest the instant he got his change at the McDonald's drive-thru. Yale would at least have things to talk about with Charlie. Information with which to fill the void. The fact that he'd never written back meant he had endless fuel. Charlie might not know yet about Fiona's college acceptance. She only got the notice last week. People had surely told him Yale was working in fundraising at DePaul, but they might not have conveyed the dreariness of the job, the way everything was about money. No art. No beauty. He'd sweated his way through the insurance interview. Said no to the AIDS question. Dr. Chang had submitted the first claim for AZT 5 months ago, and it was still under review. The insurance company wanted the names of every doctor who treated him in the past 10 years. Enyo was worried they'd do to him what they did to Katsu, find some minor illness from years back, or the one dermatologist he'd forgotten to list, and then claim misrepresentation. The insurers had a year to review it all. While Yale paid thousands of dollars out of pocket, hoping he'd eventually get reimbursed. But at least he had the job. A desk to cling to. He could tell Charlie that Bill had delayed Nora's show to the fall of 90 at the earliest, and that although Yale was in great shape, thanks for asking, he was afraid he'd never see it happen. He could tell him Nora had passed away last winter. That he'd hoped so much he could at least send her photos of the show, even if they couldn't roll her into the brig as they'd dreamed. Of course, Charlie might not even remember who Nora was. He could say that his lymph nodes had been swollen last summer, but they were fine again, and his T-cells were fantastic, and he was drinking vitamin shakes and doing visualizations. He could tell him Roscoe had gone to live with Cecily and her son, after Dr. Chang had told him he could not, under any circumstances, keep the cat and its litter box in his apartment. He could say he'd left the Marina Towers, finally, was living in a sublet in Lincoln Park, that the paint was peeling, but the place had its own washing machine. Asher said, "Can I get you to the Dagmar meeting next weekend?" Yale was never clear on Dagmar's mission, in part because the R kept changing. Dykes and gay men against Reagan, or the right, or Republicans, or repression. Every time you asked, it was something different. Yell said, It's rutabagas now, right? He pressed Asher's stamp onto his left palm. The slightest trace of red ink came off. You'll feel better, Asher said. Everyone I know who isn't political, it's just because they haven't tapped into their anger. And once you do, it'll feel right. Listen, direct action. Direct action is the third best feeling in the world. What's the second? Peeling off a wet swimsuit. Huh. Yale actually wanted to say yes. But the way he felt around Asher was unsustainable. It wasn't good for the nervous system. Besides which, what he'd seen of direct action protests involved lying down in the street, pepper spray, getting handcuffed and locked in a paddy wagon, where in summer they'd close the doors and turn the heat up. He hadn't even been able to fight off other boys in his seventh grade locker room. How was he supposed to hold his own, in front of Asher Glass, against third-generation Chicago cops? He said he'd think about it. He had a lot going on at work, he said. The one place he did see Asher regularly was at support group. Asher would constantly show up half an hour late, loosening his tie. If Yale had managed to keep an open seat next to him, usually by leaving his coat on it casually for a while, and then removing the coat as if he just suddenly remembered it was there, Asher would take it, squeeze the back of Yale's neck as he sat down. Otherwise, he'd stand outside the circle, refusing the therapist's offer to grab him one of the chairs that was still folded against the wall. When Asher talked, it was to make a speech, not to share anything about himself, about his own diagnosis or its aftermath. He'd never acquiesced to the test. But last year his weight had suddenly dropped, his stomach had revolted, and his doctor had insisted on checking his T-cells. His count was below 100. About once per meeting, he'd go off about the cost of AZT, as if they were the ones responsible, as if they could do anything about it. He'd start yelling that it was the most expensive prescription drug in history. You think that's a coincidence? You think that isn't pure hatred? $10,000 a year. $10,000! He was never one to break down in tears. Never one to sob over lost friends or mortality or survivor guilt. After the meetings, Asher would tell Yale he ought to get together with someone in the group. After a brief fling with Ross, the redhead from Marina Towers, they'd mostly had dinners together because Ross, who got tested the first weekday of every third month, was terrified of anything more than kissing, Yale had been completely celibate. That Jeremy, with the chin, Asher said once, when they went for coffee after. He's got no baggage. He's your age. He has amazing arms. I'm judging from the forearms, but I'm extrapolating. You're both positive. He lives a block from you. And he's financially independent. I'm not saying you move in together. I'm saying you exchange some bodily fluids and feel good about it. Bodily fluids were the last things Yale wanted to think about. He said, What if there are different strains? Some people think you could get... That's the biggest bullshit! They want to police your sexuality. And then, even once it's too late, they want to police it some more. There's no reason to stop getting laid. It's just that your dating pool's changed. Now, in the car, Yale wondered if Asher was inviting him to the Dagmar meeting just to fix him up with someone there. He wanted to ask... And he wanted to ask if he should be offended or flattered that Asher was always so interested in his sex life, yet had never volunteered to participate in it. Not that Yale had ever propositioned him. Not that he could. Asher said, You owe me one favor in exchange for this ride. Either you come to the meeting, or you visit Charlie. He took his eyes off of traffic long enough to look at Yale, and Yale's face did involuntary things. He tried his best to smile casually. Maybe I'll get in touch with his mom. Asher said. Does it really ever go anywhere? Does what? Love. Does it vanish? Yale looked at his own hand, resting on the dashboard to keep himself steady whenever Asher braked suddenly. I mean, we never want it to. But it does, doesn't it? Asher said. I think that's the saddest thing in the world. The failure of love. Not hatred, but the failure of love. He didn't go see Charlie that night, although maybe that was the day he knew he would eventually. He didn't see him for a year and a half, not until October of 1989, when Charlie, although it had nothing to do with that infected eyelid a year and a half earlier, had gone blind. Teresa met him at the elevator. She'd aged a million years. Yale had been to Masonic for a few tests, but he hadn't been up to Unit 371 since he'd visited Terrence that once, years ago. The acquaintances who'd landed here, like Charlie's copy editor Dwight, hadn't been close enough friends to visit. The place looked worn in now, in a good way. Broadway posters hung on the walls, and the place was done up for Halloween. A man in a gown leaned on the nurse's station chatting, his feet in fuzzy yellow slippers, his arms covered with lesions. There was a board with Polaroids of all the staff and volunteers, their names markered on the white strips. The biggest difference this time was that Yale knew that unless his insurance fell through when he ended up at County, he was looking at the unit where he himself would die. This would be his final home, and the faces of those two passing nurses would, in time, be the ones he was most familiar with in the world. He would know every detail of this linoleum, every light fixture. He hugged Teresa and asked how things were. They've moved him to a single, she said. And I don't think it's a good sign, do you? I just want to sleep. He's been under a lot of sedation lately, and they had to sedate him again this morning for his bronchoscopy, and he's still quite out of it. I don't know that he'll know you're here, necessarily. I should have called you back and said, but I was hoping he'd be recovered by now. The thing is, he's not, even when he's not sedated, he's not fully here. I should have said. It's okay, he said. It's okay. Yale followed her, and as he first entered the room, he squinched his eyes shut. He opened them slowly, to a man who wasn't Charlie. He wanted to tell Teresa she'd taken him to the wrong place, that this withered fetus on the bed was no one he knew. But Teresa was stroking this man's scalp. And when the man's mouth hung open, Yale saw Charlie's teeth. He was an alien. An Auschwitz skeleton. A baby bird fallen from its nest. Yale's mind kept reaching for metaphors, because the simple fact of it, that this was Charlie, was too much. There wasn't much room between the door and the bed, but Yale covered it as slowly as he could. He grasped the bed rail, looked at the cards taped to the walls. Teresa was tired, and Yale told her he could stay, told her to go home and rest. She hugged him and left. He didn't know if he should talk. He could explain that he was here, check Charlie's face for a reaction. But with the sedative still in effect, and with Charlie blind, Yale had a cushion of anonymity right now. One it would feel safe to stay in. At least for today. Later, if Charlie was ever lucid, he could tell him everything he'd been wanting to. The good parts, at least. He could say, at least once, that he forgave him. And even if Charlie never fully woke up, well, he'd still say it. Maybe it would still count. He sat on the chair by the bed. The nurse came in, and she showed Yale a small pink sponge on the end of a stick, showed him how he could hold it to Charlie's lips to give him water. He did it for a while, and he ran his thumb over Charlie's wrist, listening to the thrumming of the walls. He fed him water, drop by drop. He could feel it all around him, how down the corridor, and down other hallways of other hospitals round Chicago and the other godforsaken cities of the globe. 1,000 other men did the same. 2015. It made no sense. Or maybe it did. It had to. She was awake, and it was 2015, and here was a man, very much alive, whose eyes and gestures and voice were Julian's. Fiona sat on the studio's cement floor, the back of her head against a cupboard. Julian was explaining to the rest of them what Fiona had stammered in the hallway. "What's the line about rumors of my death? Richard, should I be insulted that you never talk about me?" Serge found the whole thing hilarious, called Julian a zombie, laughed at the look on Fiona's face. Cecily didn't know Julian. She got Fiona a damp paper towel for her forehead. Richard said, "Fiona, I only found him myself 2 years ago. We knew you didn't know where he was. That was the surprise. But if I'd thought for an instant that you'd believed he was... Listen, I'd never have sprung that on you." How much had she even talked to Richard in the past 2 years? Not at all, really. She'd emailed to ask if she could come. Before that, well, it felt like they'd talked, but that was just a product of seeing his name pop up so often in the world, and of their being such old friends. Julian stood above her, helpless, running his thumb across his chin. She stared at his face, the ways it had changed. Beyond the normal transformations of age, he had what she recognized as some facial wasting from AZT, and, she was certain, cheek implants to counter the fat loss. Not great ones, either. A couple of her volunteers at the store had similar cheeks. And his face had broadened, the steroids presumably, so that he looked blocky, carved. Still handsome, but profoundly different. As if he'd been reconstituted from a police sketch. He said, "I work in accounting for Universal. We're shooting right on Richard Street. Not that I get to be on set. They only flew me in 3 days ago, and I'm in a sad little office." She said, "Where, usually..." But she didn't have words for the rest of what should have been an easy question. "I'm in L.A. I looked for you on Facebook, you know. A bunch of times." "Oh. Hey. I'm sorry." She wasn't sure why he'd said it, but she worried he'd read her mind. Why, she was thinking, should it be Julian Ames, of all people, to show up, a ghost at the door? Why not Nico or Terrence or Yale? Why not Teddy Naples, who'd evaded the virus only to die in 99 of a heart attack in front of his class? Why not Charlie Keene, for that matter, who was an asshole but did so much good? She'd loved Julian, she had. But why him? She made herself smile, because she hadn't smiled yet. "I really did try to find you," he said. "I should have asked Richard." His voice was the same. Julian's voice. "You did ask, remember? Last year in L.A. And I said I'd get you her email. I forgot, of course." She said, "It's okay." Richard said, "I feel like a lout." They decided what everyone needed was sandwiches, and Serge was dispatched to buy them. By the time he came back with 5 plastic-wrapped baguettes of ham and cheese in a paper bag, they were all sitting around the table, and Richard had adroitly diffused the awkwardness with a story about the time Yale Tishman had thrown a birthday party for his roommate at Masonic, a man he just met who'd had no one in town to visit him. Yale had told them all to bring little presents, and Fiona, to be funny, had bought a playgirl on the way, only to learn on arrival that the guy was straight. A gruff IV drug user from downstate. He was not amused, Richard said. Fiona still felt detached, floaty, confused. She kept looking at her own hands. If these were the same hands she'd had all along, then it wasn't impossible that Julian Ames was sitting here across from her, opening his sandwich, asking if Richard had any napkins. There were events she'd believed herself, for years, to be the sole custodian of, when all along those parties, those conversations, those jokes had stayed alive in him as well. Julian said, "Leaving is one of my greatest regrets in life, Fiona. I want you to know. I thought I was running off to spare everyone, and really I was abandoning them. I'd never imagined they could go before I did. Not in a million years. And I know from Richard, I know you took care of Yale in particular. It should have been me. I should have been there for him." "Cecily was there too," Fiona's voice croaked out as if she hadn't talked in a week. "It was me and Cecily in the hospital. We did shifts." Cecily said, "It was mostly you. But he died alone." It was the cruelest thing Fiona could have said. Not just to Julian, but to Richard and Cecily, too. And to herself. He died completely alone. Julian set his sandwich down and looked at her until she looked back. "Richard told me," he said. I know it wasn't your fault. Anyone could have died alone. You know, the middle of the night, if it wasn't the middle of the night." Cecily put a cool hand to the back of Fiona's neck. Serge mouthed something to Richard, and Richard mouthed back, "New York." Serge must have been asking where Richard was when Yale died. Richard's career had been blowing up. Fiona, to change the subject, managed to ask Julian to recount his last 3 decades. "If you're asking how I'm still alive," Julian said, "I have no idea." But he did, really. He'd gone to Puerto Rico in 86, then he'd stayed a year, mooching off an old friend, selling t-shirts on the beach and getting stoned. "I was so sure I was ready to die," he said. "And then when I heard about AZT, it was like if you were trying to drown, but someone threw you a rope, and you couldn't stop yourself from grabbing it." The problem was that Julian had no insurance, and the drug cost more than half of what he'd made a year back in Chicago. So he went home to Valdosta, Georgia, where his mother, who thought she'd never see him again, was happy to let him live in his childhood bedroom. Happy to spend his father's life insurance and remortgage her house for her youngest child. "She was a saint," he said. "A southern gentlewoman. She was built for church and afternoon tea, but it turns out she was also built for crisis. For a while she made him keep working. He got a job with a local film production company, because she was so certain he'd survive, and that when he was cured, he wouldn't want a gap on his resume." Fiona remembered Julian's sweet optimism before his diagnosis, the way he was always sure the disease would be cured, sure he was just about to become famous. He must have gotten it from his mother all along. He grew sicker and sicker despite her care, developed resistance to the AZT. "I had about half a T-cell left," he said. "I weighed 108 pounds. Richard said, "And that's when I saw you." Fiona knew Richard had run into Julian in New York sometime in the early 90s, that Julian had come up there with a friend to see 1 or 2 good shows before he died. He was in a wheelchair. This was when Richard had taken that last photo of him, the 3rd photo of the triptych. Richard had called her afterward, and then she'd called Teddy to marvel over the fact that Julian had lasted that long. "Right. And after that, I was in the hospital for a solid year. That New York trip was a bad idea, in retrospect," Serge said. "And then what?" He was the only one who'd finished his sandwich. Then it was 96. Suddenly the good drugs came out. There's a few months I don't even remember. I was so out of it. And when the fog lifted, I was home again. I could lift my arms and I could eat food. Next thing you know, I'm jogging. I mean, really, it took a while, but that's what it felt like. For a long time, you'll appreciate this, Fiona. For a long time, I wondered if I was a ghost. A literal ghost. I thought I must have died and this was some kind of purgatory or heaven. Because how was it even possible, you know? But then I thought, if this is heaven, where are all my friends? It couldn't be heaven if Yale and Nico and everyone weren't there. So I guess this is just plain old Earth. And I'm still on it. Serge excused himself to answer the phone. He'd been texting all day. And although all his acquaintances seemed accounted for, not all of their acquaintances were. And there were still urgent and worrisome things to be discussed. Julian said, "My husband had basically the same experience. He calls this his second life. To me, that sounds too born again. But then he didn't grow up in the South. He's right, though. That's what it feels like." There was a ring, a golden wedding band on Julian's left hand. How utterly strange that Julian could have a second life, a whole entire life, when Fiona had been living for the past 30 years in a deafening echo. She'd been tending the graveyard alone, oblivious to the fact that the world had moved on, that one of the graves had been empty this whole time. "Speaking of mothers," Julian said, "and speaking of Yale Tishman, Richard, did I ever tell you I met Yale's mom? Maybe 12 years ago." Fiona put her hands flat on the table, steadied herself. If Julian was indeed a ghost, he was a tormenting one. He turned to Fiona and Cecily. "I was working on set for this sitcom pilot called Follywood. You never heard of it. It didn't get picked up, thank God. And she was playing a doctor. I wouldn't have recognized her face, but I knew her name. Jane Greenspan. Remember?" Fiona remembered the woman's nose, just like Yale's, and her broad mouth. She'd seen her pixelated 100 times, and in real life only once, only briefly. That Tylenol commercial ran for a few years, and Fiona had slowly memorized her face, knew it well enough to recognize her when she'd pop up in other ads throughout the years. "Why?" she'd lamented to anyone who would listen, except for Yale himself. Why did that have to be the parent who'd left? Of all the parents, of all the gay men she knew, an actress mother would have understood a gay son, wouldn't she? For Yale to be alienated from her for reasons that had nothing to do with his sexuality just felt excessive, perverse. Richard asked Julian if he'd talked to her. And Julian said, "Not about Yale. It would have felt cruel. I don't know. I mean, how do you even start that conversation? I was good friends with the son you abandoned. And then I thought, what if she didn't know he died?" "She did," Fiona said. And her voice was cracked glass. She couldn't breathe. Even though she didn't want to be out on the street, she was about to say that she needed fresh air. But Serge had gone to the door and was returning, having let Jake Austin into the studio. And then she was stuck, because everything had to be explained, the story told over. The misunderstanding, the strange reunion, Richard's chagrin, Julian's whole life. Jake grinned like it was the coolest thing in the world. "Okay," he said. "I gotta say, I feel a little vindicated. This is why I wanted to ask about the triptych, Fiona. Because I saw the update. I mean, you sounded so sure of yourself, I thought maybe I'd misunderstood." Fiona didn't follow, and Richard explained how last year, when Julian had passed through Paris, he'd taken his photo again. One of the pieces for the show was an updated group of four photos.
A quadriptych, he said.
Doesn't exactly roll off the tongue.
Can you believe it? Julian said. After all this time, I'm a model again.
And the way he said it was so exactly like Julian Ames, so much the way he'd have said it at age 25, that Fiona walked straight over to where he sat and kissed him on the forehead.
I'm so glad you're here, she said. I'm so, 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 so glad.
1990. Even though they were only going to march, not chain themselves to lampposts or anything, Yale and Fiona had written Gloria's phone number on their arms with a Sharpie, as well as the number for Asher's law office, although Asher was far more likely to get locked up than they were. Gloria had a sprained ankle, but had volunteered as a remote bail buddy to at least 10 different protesters, and Yale was concerned that if they all got arrested, she'd run out of money, leave him to languish.
She's the most responsible person I ever met, Fiona said.
It was true. Charlie used to say she was the one writer in the world who'd never missed a deadline. Gloria had left Out Loud behind and was at the Trib now, writing features. But just in case, Yale wrote Cecily's number too. They both wore bandanas tied loosely around their necks, though Yale had doubts they'd work against tear gas. He felt like a silly cowboy. They headed down to the loop on the L, and Yale tried not to let Fiona see how terrified he was. He'd gone to the candlelight vigil outside Cook County Hospital on Saturday night, staying till 2 in the morning, eating soup and sharing a blanket with Asher and Fiona and Asher's friend from New York, but that had felt far safer. Candles reminded him of a religious service, and after a while everyone was sitting. Only a few hundred people, some guitars, a silly fashion show at one point. An actual march was different. And the overzealous guy who'd called him late last night from the ACT UP phone tree had reminded him to let friends and family know where he'd be. He'd suggested wearing a second, padded backpack in the front. Sometimes they get baton happy, he said. So just sweaters in there, whatever. But Yale only owned one backpack. He put a sweatshirt in, a spare bandana, and a bottle of water. He put his inhaler into one pants pocket, and a plastic baggie with 3 days of pills into the other, in case he was detained. 85 pills, $70-some worth. Thank God for insurance. The train was full of Monday morning commuters, men in suits, women in blazers, a few kids in private school uniforms. Everything had started at 8 at the Prudential Building, but it was already 8:45, and they'd likely have to meet the crowd on its way up Michigan to the Blue Cross offices. Yale had the Xeroxed route map folded in his pocket, a huge loop that looked like way too much walking. The American Medical Association was the next big stop, followed by another insurance place, and finally back to Daly Plaza, where they'd plant themselves in front of the county building to protest the closure of half the AIDS beds at Cook County and the fact that the ward wouldn't take women. Fiona managed to find a seat and insisted Yale take it. He felt fine, really, except that his stomach had been a mess for a few days. A different kind of mess than the drugs made it. This was sharp cramping, sloshing. It might have been the start of everything, or it might have been nerves. Once he was sitting below her, she said,
"So I have a problem. I'm in love with my sociology professor."
Yale laughed. "Thief, like unrequited love, or like you're getting some extra credit?"
"I mean, he calls me at home, but we haven't... It's not against the law or anything."
"Tell me he's not 60, Yale said. "Oh, God, is he married?"
"No, and no. He's your age, maybe."
"But you're in his class."
"Right. Well, I was. The exams are this week."
"You should be studying."
"Shut up. So, I take the exam, And then what?
Fiona was flushed. If she was trying to keep her face neutral, it wasn't working. It was a beautiful thing to see. A happy Fiona. Fiona in love. He said, "Maybe you wait till grades are filed. For propriety. And then, you know."
"Really? I thought you'd be the one to talk sense into me. You're supposed to be my most sensible friend."
"Fief, you're asking advice from someone who's increasingly aware that life is very short. Wait till you have your grade, then go to his office and unzip his pants." He'd been talking quietly, but Fiona shrieked.
"That is such a gay move, Yale."
No one looked. If anything, they thought she was insulting him generically.
"I'm pretty sure it works on straight guys, too.
Seriously, how many lives do you have? How many times are you going to be 25? Fiona raised an eyebrow. Her eyebrows were darker than her hair, and Yale loved that it gave her a perpetually sardonic look. She said,
"Are you following your own advice?
I'm about to take part in some mob action, aren't I? Does that really seem like a thing I'd do?"
"Not at all. But I know why you're doing it. It's not because life is short. It's because you're in love with Asher."
He was going to protest. But the blood had come to his cheeks and ears so fast he could hear it, and it would be even more embarrassing now to attempt a denial. She'd seen him at the vigil, after all, mooning around, worrying whether Asher was sleeping with his friend from New York, watching the way the candle lit Asher's face from below. Yale said, "Well, he had some good points. He was no more or less in love with Asher than he'd always been. Which is to say, he'd always been fairly deeply in love with Asher if he admitted it to himself. Which lately he was willing to do. It wasn't that he'd been spending more time with him than he always had, but he had more opportunity to sit back and watch him. As Asher spoke at benefits, headed up community meetings, got himself on TV when the quilt came to Navy Pier, got himself on TV when he was arrested. And Yale was finally letting himself, from that distance, look at something he'd always known would burn his eyes. Asher had spent a full hour at the vigil talking Yale into marching today. "You embarrass someone on the 6 o'clock news," he'd said. "How much more effective is that than writing a letter? Nothing else you do will make this much difference. And this is the big one. This is it." His full New York accent had come out. He jabbed a finger at Yale's chest way too hard, and then apologized. Dagmar had rolled into the Chicago branch of ACT UP, and Asher was providing a lot of its legal counsel, plus facing the pepper spray himself. Most protests brought out 20 or 30 stalwarts, but this one was national. People flying in from all over to target AMA headquarters and the AMA's opposition to national insurance. And the county hospital system, too. And the insurance companies. And Lord knew what else. The whole thing felt confusing to Yale. But bigger was better, according to Asher. "If we're not fighting for poor black women who need beds at county," Asher said, "we're as bad as the fucking Republicans. You don't just go into this looking out for yourself. And Yale," he'd said. And Yale was slightly surprised that Asher had remembered his presence, remembered he wasn't just giving a speech to the ether. "I think you'd be great at this, long term. Maybe behind the scenes. But we need you. We're gonna need new leaders all the time. The problem with this movement is the leaders keep dying. We gotta have subs." There'd been a drop of wax rolling down Asher's candle, getting dangerously close to his hand. Yale had reached out and stopped it with his thumbnail, which is probably when Fiona had realized, if she hadn't already. The crowd was indeed on the move by the time Yale and Fiona joined it, streaming north over the Michigan Avenue Bridge. Some of the protesters wore doctor's coats, a nice touch, and most carried signs, "Death by Loophole," "Bloody Money," an elaborate one about George Bush having a drug czar but no AIDS czar. Danielle felt like a bland supernumerary. No one wore double backpacks. Not a single person.